from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Ray Suarez in today for Michael Krasny.
Because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
President-elect Barack Obama in 2008 delivering his victory speech in Chicago. Tonight, President Obama will be back in Chicago for a farewell speech to the nation. This evening's address will be a moment for him to reflect on his 8 years in the Oval Office, and in this hour, we invite you to do the same. From promises that sank to those that soared and everything in between, what will Obama's legacy be for you? Call us now at 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org. All coming up next on Forum after this. Welcome to Forum on KQED. I'm Ray Suarez, sitting in for Michael Krasny. It all began with so much hope and, for once, widely shared optimism. Barack Obama had won the presidency in November of 2008 by 9.5 million votes and an overwhelming Electoral College majority. By the inauguration, the new young president's approval ratings far outpaced the margins he had won from the voters. The country was in a bad way, and high hopes were placed on the president's shoulders. Soon it will be 8 years exactly since that frigid day in Washington, D.C. To avoid the monumental traffic snarls, I bundled up and rode my bike 15 miles to the studio that morning and saw people pouring out of subway stations miles away from the National Mall on the Virginia side of the Potomac River, ready to cross Memorial Bridge on foot and join the happy crowds that packed the Capitol's famous open spaces, from the Lincoln Memorial to the Washington Monument, then from the Washington Monument to the west front of the U.S. Capitol, an enormous crowd that fit the singular moment, the nation's first black president, an uplifting and hopeful inaugural address, and a walk down frosty Pennsylvania Avenue to the reviewing stand by the White House. Tonight, a different Barack Obama will take a Chicago stage just miles from the Hyde Park neighborhood where his political career began and say goodbye to the country as president. His face lined, his hair gray, his little girls almost grown, he'll recap an extraordinary time in the life of the country, a time of uneven economic recovery, incomplete withdrawal from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a passing of the office to a man who won the presidency by promising to erase, negate Barack Obama's 8 years as president. What do you want to hear in tonight's reassessment? What are your own estimations of the highs, lows, accomplishments, and failures of the Obama years? We want to hear from you a lot this hour on the forum. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Kicking us off as we look ahead to tonight's Chicago address is Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Has there been any word from inside Obama world what the president's going to talk about tonight?
Well, you know, one of the things that happens with these speeches, especially the ones that are very personal for the president, is that he works on them late into the night. And then, you know, oftentimes, you know, even in the motorcade as he's heading to the venue where he delivers them. So they're not the White House has, for the last 8 years that I've covered this place, rarely provided advanced copies. But what they generally have said is, look, this is he's going to touch on the themes that had been sort of the persistent themes of his presidency. He's going to talk about that early period that you mentioned when the economy was so bad when he came in and the struggles that he went through to kind of right the ship economically. He's going to talk about healthcare and what he sees as his legacy in attempting to fix the healthcare system in the country. He's going to talk about kind of efforts at democracy promotion and efforts to confront the the terror scourge across the globe. And, you know, I suspect he'll also talk about some of the race relations issues that have, you know, especially in his second term, have been so persistent, the racial violence across the country, and his efforts to try to help the country work through those moments. So I think you're likely to get a speech with a lot of sweep, and you know, his effort to put all of those things into the best possible light as he departs.
At this moment, when a lot of people are sort of summing up in their own heads what it was all about, what for you are the milestones, the important markers in just about 3,000 days as president?
You know, it's hard. My family asks me that all the time. Like, what do you remember most? I mean, I think, you know, it's hard not to remember the difficult moments, right? The moments when I remember being on Martha's Vineyard, which during one of President Obama's vacations there. And it was just one of the worst weeks that I can remember. The attacks against ISIS had started. One of the American journalists, the first American journalist, was beheaded during that week. And then that was the week that Ferguson exploded in Missouri, in terms of the racial violence that followed the shooting there. And so I remember the president having multiple press conferences, having to deal with how to kind of tamp down on the, you know, the violence in St. Louis, but at the same time dealing with the horrors overseas. So I think those are the moments that stick in my mind. But clearly there were some, you know, a lot of positive moments too. And depending on your perspective and your political perspective, you might look at things differently. Obviously, there's a lot of the country that looks at the healthcare. I was at the White House the night the healthcare bill was finally passed, and I was the pool reporter that night. And you know, clearly a lot of the country looks at that as a positive moment, and a lot of the country doesn't. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how history views all this once we're kind of years down the road.
Did the president underestimate his opponents?
I think he would even say he would. I guess that depends on. I think that's a hard question to answer definitively. But I even think that he would probably say that the hope that he expressed during the campaign, and I remember it quite clearly on the campaign trail throughout 2008, this notion that he was going to somehow be able to bridge the divide. And to kind of he frequently said, I'm going to change the way Washington works. And I think that has been one of the signature failures of his presidency, is that he leaves 8 years later and Washington works exactly the same way it has always worked, which is to say not at all in some cases. And I think he would probably acknowledge that he underestimated the extent to which his adversaries would you know, choose a kind of path of complete obstruction as a way, as a political strategy for both stopping the president's agenda and to some extent getting their own agenda pushed through.
In the White House, and the White House is more than just one man or woman, apart from the Oval Office, in the very large political and policy operation that comes out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, is there a dark realization of just how intent the new crowd is on making it like Barack Obama was never president?
Yes. It's interesting you mention it. I had lunch yesterday with a very senior member of the administration and to talk about this topic. And, you know, there is sort of a hope and a kind of clinging to the belief that there are some things that the president and those aides put in place over these last 8 years that won't be easily reversed. There are, for example, all sorts of programs that are sort of public, private, state, local, federal partnerships to deal with, for example, preschool education or free college education, free community college, economic development programs. A lot of those are, you know, sort of federally financed with money that's already in the pipeline and are projects that are put in place by state governments where the leadership hasn't changed. And so I think there's a sense that some of those will just continue, that they sort of continue under the radar, and that the Trump administration doesn't do a whole lot to change those. Having said that, they sort of cling to that, but they recognize that on really big things, Obamacare, immigration policy, certainly a ton of foreign policy, all of that gets, I think, completely turned around, and there is a real sense of sadness on the part of the administration that they worked so hard for the last 8 years to, from their perspective, put in place things they thought were right for the country, and a lot of that's going to be turned around.
We're talking about the legacy of Barack Obama's presidency. He wraps up 8 years as president this month. Joining us to talk about the two terms is the New York Times White House correspondent Michael Shear. Our number is 866-733-6786. We'll go first to Sebastian, Florida. Nancy, welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I just want to comment on my take from President Obama's two terms, which is it's the first time in many, many, many presidencies that we had a family in the White House where there was no scandal, there was no drama, there was nothing but grace, dignity, honesty, integrity, and treating people fairly and looking out for all of the people in this country, not just those who can afford to contribute to campaigns. I think they are an amazing family. I'm sorry to see them go. I'm hoping that America can continue to move in the direction that the Obamas and the presidency has led us. The country is a better place for having this man as our leader for the last 8 years. I hope everybody can take away the same feeling.
Nancy, thanks a lot for your call. Michael Shear, I wonder if a presidency ever thinks consciously, okay, tomorrow we're going to be graceful. When you shape a public image, a side of your life that you're going to show to the people, because the president is the embodiment of the state for a lot of people, the Obamas had a special responsibility as the first black family to occupy the White House. Did they put a lot of energy and care into what they showed the public of their lives?
I mean, you know, that's hard to say. I mean, you have to sort of get inside their head. I think so. I mean, my sense is that President Obama, even by the time he had become a U.S. senator, but certainly by the time he was elected president, had, you know, had thought pretty deeply about kind of the what kind of presence he is on the public stage, right? And that can be seen in a couple of different ways. I remember talking to a lot of Republicans when I covered the McCain campaign in 2008, and the Republicans viewed that aspect of President Obama as a sort of fake persona, right? That he had created this sort of kind of appealing persona, a persona that he thought it would appeal to a lot of folks, both whites, blacks, and everybody else. And from the Republican perspective, they thought that was a kind of an artifice. I think Obama and his family would say that, in fact, kind of what you said, which is that they felt a special responsibility to put on display for the country a kind of manner that was beyond reproach and above being assailed, because they felt that responsibility that if they didn't do that, if they were somehow mired in scandal or didn't put a good face forward, that in addition to all the other pressures, people would say, well, there you go. That's what happens. It's a black family or whatever. And that he felt that extra burden, since he was the first. But it's hard to say how much of it was a kind of deliberative thing and how much of it was just a determination to kind of live the way, you know, he wanted him and his family to live.
San Leandro, California is next. T, welcome to Forum.
Hi there. I just want to say Obama's legacy for somebody like me is very important because he looked like me, and having somebody in a position of power meant a lot. And the next 4 years will be interesting seeing somebody who wants to erase that. Kind of for some of us millennials, we take that personally. But being making sure the next 4 years we stick to fact-based is very important, but Obama legacy means a lot for somebody like me. So it's very important to just sad to see him go is pretty much what I'm trying to say.
Thanks a lot for your call. Michael Shearer, even if that legacy is assailed in the near term over the first term of Donald Trump, I guess, and as I've certainly heard that in your earlier remarks, that there is a longer-term negotiation that goes on, and that some of these initiatives may come back in subsequent White Houses. There's sometimes backlash. There's sometimes a sort of slingshot effect to policy when a new leader works too hard at making sure the past didn't happen.
Well, I'll give you an example of one that I think we still don't know the real fate of, and that's the health care law. People call it Obamacare. A couple of my colleagues who have spent years writing about that issue wrote a very long story the other day in our paper that looked at the issue of how Obamacare has reshaped the kind of way in which the health care system at its core, not you know, on the margins, but at its core, how doctors and hospitals approach the provision of basic health care, that they're far less fee for service, where you get sick and you go to a doctor when you get sick, and they are shifting dramatically towards a way of kind of providing wellness care well before you get sick, and that is a legacy of this law. Even if some of the more well-known provisions, the healthcare exchanges and some of these other things, even if that gets changed by Donald Trump and the Republican Congress, that there is a kind of much more deeper level legacy that the law has forced the entire healthcare system in the country to kind of adapt to and change, and that those changes are unlikely to be reversed, that your typical community hospital is still going to pursue the kinds of things that President Obama's health system, health law pushed them to pursue, regardless of who's in the White House. So that's one example of the way in which things that a president does, and certainly a president who's in for 8 years, have a tendency to kind of become firmly rooted in the country, no matter who the successor is.
We're getting a lot of feedback online. Mason writes, who can forget the administration's skirting of the limitations of war powers and its interference in Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and Syria? I'm likely forgetting a couple of countries. Chirag tweets, the Obama legacy can be summed up by the extrajudicial killing of innocent 16-year-old U.S.-born Abdulrahman al-Awlaki by drone strike. And that's the teenage son of the Muslim cleric from the United States who moved back to Yemen, his family's country of origin, and began to agitate against the United States. He was killed by drone strike, but also his son, Abdulrahman. Skip writes, Obama has had an uncanny inability to work with the Congress. I'll start again. Skip writes, Obama has had an uncanny inability to work with the Congress. His typical retort has been that there were obstructionist Republicans in control of the Congress who would not work with him because they simply didn't like him. Regardless, it is part of the job to get along with and work with the Congress. If he couldn't do that, then he shouldn't have been president. What about that? A long-running feud between the White House and the leadership in Congress. Did the president have a possibility of having a different kind of relationship with his Republican opponents, a more productive one?
I think he did. This is one that I've fought with White House folks, Obama White House folks, for years over. They hate this notion. They sort of hate the idea that they very much think, look, this is all the fault of Republicans and Republican obstructionism. I will say I did a story a couple years back in which I set out with a colleague of mine, Carl Hulse, I sought out to kind of document the friendship, the relationships that President Obama has with members of Congress, even in his own party. And it was a real struggle. I mean, it was every single senator that I talked to, every single representative that I talked to who were Democrats who you would think would have a long relationship. I mean, essentially, the answer was there really isn't, but he's a loner and we don't really have much relationship with him. And I got to the point where, you know, the White House kept saying, no, you got to talk to this senator and this senator. And I finally had to say, look, you have to stop sending me senators because each one you send me tells me they don't have any relationship with the president. And, So I do think there was, you know, there was an aspect of his personality that just didn't really, you know, didn't really see that part of the schmoozing part of the job as really important. And I think in the end, that kind of came back to cause him problems.
Michael Scheer is in Washington, where he's White House correspondent for The New York Times. The number is 866-733-6786. We'll go next to Norman. To Emily in San Francisco. Emily, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you guys? So I'm just really curious. I feel like during his administration, Obama acted a lot like his hands were tied and he was being stuck, not be able to pass certain gun laws, certain Democratic laws that he normally would because of the Congress, the Republican Congress, House and Senate. But now that he's retired, I wonder if he's going to take on a similar role like Bernie Sanders, standing up for the Dakota Access Pipeline, if he's going to stay in D.C. and continue to be a politician, or if he's just going to use his presidency to kind of become a celebrity, is what I see the trend going to. But I really hope that he stays in the White House, he keeps making efforts for LGBT, people of color, teachers, students, working class Americans. But we just don't know. So yeah, that's where I'm coming from.
Michael, do we know much about what the president has planned?
We know a little bit. I mean, I think here's what I think you could expect. First of all, the president has said repeatedly that he very much admired George W. Bush's position throughout the 8 years that Obama was in office, which is to say that George W. Bush almost never entered the public debate and in a way of criticizing the president, the current president. So I think you're not likely to see Obama become a kind of, you know, forceful and constant critic against Donald Trump. I think that's unlikely. I think the first thing he's going to do is take some time off, and then I think you're going to see him write a book. And I expect the book to be a huge, you know, popular success, and I think it's largely likely to focus on the issue of race, though maybe more broadly. And then, you know, he's setting up one of these foundations, and I don't expect him to sort of shy away from a whole series of topics. I think he said already that he wants to be involved in issues like voter rights. I think he wants to be involved in issues surrounding young black men and kind of the economic situation that they face. And I do know that there are people in the LGBT community who really want him to be continue to stand up for them. So I think you'll see some of that activism later on after he finishes this.
We were joined by Michael Scheer, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks a lot, Michael. We'll continue our conversation about President Obama's legacy. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. You can email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Michael Krasny. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ray Suarez, in today for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the highs, lows, accomplishments, and failures of the Obama years. Michael Scheer is the White House correspondent for The New York Times. He joined us earlier. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email your questions to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Back to the phones. Let's go next to Norman in San Leandro. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. My comment is about when Obama first came into office, he kept Bob Gates, George Bush's Secretary of Defense. And, you know, he won the election by basically a change from George Bush. And then he kept his Secretary of Defense. And the second comment is when he was running against Hillary and all of the other candidates, the Democrats, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, called back all of the candidates off the campaign trail to vote on the Patriot Act, to reinstate the Patriot Act, yes or no. Hillary Clinton voted against reinstating the Patriot Act, but Obama voted for it. So there's two things that put him on the trajectory of George Bush's presidency.
Well, Bob Gates was brought in late in the Bush years to sort of clean house after Donald Rumsfeld. Do you think Bob Gates was a bad Secretary of Defense? He was retained.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely. Bob Gates was brought into the Bush presidency to supposedly the war in Iraq was at its peak of problems. And he came in and basically just continued on with the, it was a troop surge, if you'll recall. Well, that wasn't what we voted for. We didn't vote for to continue on with George Bush's policies in Iraq.
Well, no, the surge happened during the late Bush years, and Obama began to pull down the numbers almost immediately when he took over, under the watchful gaze of Bob Gates, who he had retained at the Pentagon. You're right. The country didn't vote for a continued high level of troop presence in Iraq. President Obama brought them down under the Status of Forces Agreement signed by the Bush administration. They were brought down to basically zero. Isn't that what you wanted, Norman?
Well, no. What I wanted was for him to tear down that Shia-led Iranian-style government, public government that George Bush put in there, and put a Sunni government back in, like Saddam Hussein. You know, they already killed Saddam Hussein, so they couldn't put him personally, but it should have been a Sunni government, not a Shiite government. He dismantled all of the government of Saddam Hussein. All of those people were sent home without pay, and a million-man army, all of those generals went home without pay and without any job for the future. And what do you, they become? They become the, well, the radicals became ISIS.
Right. And those are all things that happened during the Bush administration, not the Obama administration. The installation of a Sunni government again in Iraq would have meant Iraq not becoming a democracy in any sense of the word after the United States spent lives and considerable treasure in that part of the world. Let's go next to Charlotte in Macon, Georgia. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I would like to address the comments a little bit earlier. I think you were reading from an email and discussing how Obama said Congress was stopping him from getting anything done. It seems to me that this country seems to forget that Mitch McConnell and his Republican cronies said at the very beginning after Obama was elected that they would not let him do anything. Their whole agenda seemed to be, if it's not what the Republicans want, and we will not let anything pass, instead of being what is best for this country. So why does everybody forget what Mitch McConnell and the Republicans said and did?
Well, they were also returned with even greater power after each midterm election. And for his own part, Mitch McConnell defended his obstruction by saying, you know, we won an election, too, and I'm the Senate Majority Leader. I guess you don't agree with that point of view.
No, I believe that it was said after Obama was elected that they would not let him accomplish anything.
Right. Mitch McConnell famously said, job number one is to make Barack Obama a one-term president.
Yes. So isn't that anti-American? I mean, it's not what is best for America. It is what is best for the Republican Party. And I would like to know why this isn't discussed more and looked at instead of, you know, yes, Obama was weak. He didn't do anything. I mean, these guys had it out from the very beginning to stop anything.
It was discussed plenty, but the Republicans were never punished electorally for it. In a highly polarized atmosphere, their voters doubled down and returned even more opponents in the Congress with each election to work against the president and his agenda, even as Barack Obama was winning by a comfortable margin over Mitt Romney in the 2012 race. Charlotte, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Richboro, Pennsylvania. Evan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's on your
I'd
mind?
Like to comment, I'd like to comment first on a couple of, I don't know if they're phenomenons, but phenomena or absurdities. So first, it kind of seems that Obama gets blamed for all of the sort of shortcomings of the Bush administration, like the economic recession, and he sort of gets all of his wins taken away from him, you know, particularly getting us out of Iraq, but then getting blamed for the, you know, what sort of happened due to our destabilizing Iraq. So I just wanted to quickly comment on that. Secondly, I was 14 years old when Obama took office, and I just remember feeling a great sense of pride and optimism, which especially after having 8 years, since I was 8 years old, being we were in the Iraq War and Afghanistan, and just seeing the sort of, you know, how stressful a time that was for our country. And then when I'm 14, enter high school, and Obama takes office and just comes in with a message of hope. And all I've seen personally is just a sincere grace and love for the country from President Obama and from First Lady Michelle Obama. And I think that's ultimately what he'll be remembered for, is just his honest love for the American people and wanting to push us further and make us a better nation.
Even when they weren't loving him back, Evan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the, you know, catch 22 of being a leader, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Josh tweets, Obama's worst legacy, drone strikes and warrantless surveillance of Americans. Turnkey totalitarianism is now under Trump's control. Jason writes, Obama's legacy will be the dignity, gravitas, and class. He was the right person to bring it to the presidency. Vicky writes, there has never been a more intelligent, enlightened, and generous public servant in the White House. We will get an education now about how valuable that was for the country. Obama's failures are not his. Their failures in our system, which he was unable to change completely. And Jaime tweets, President Obama fundamentally changed the national tone. He's been an unparalleled, compassionate consoler-in-chief. Let's go next to Santa Rosa, California. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for your program. A couple of things I wanted to mention is, I think that President Obama brought more style and dignity and grace and intelligence to the White House since President Kennedy. I think his one black mark might be the Syria situation, but I think his Affordable Care Act. We made such great strides with gay marriage, and this is going to be such a grave setback. I believe in all of the things that President Obama did. He was stonewalled from the beginning with Republicans. The first thing McConnell said was, our goal is to make him a one-term president instead of our goal is to work with President Obama for the betterment of the country. And I think it's pretty amazing that he got anything done, much less some really wonderful, the Iran agreement. I think history is going to be looking at him far better than most people realize at this point.
You know, a lot of people listening, Danny, probably nodded their head when you pointed out that that Syria was a low point over the last years. But it's also hard for us to remember the state of mind of the country when Obama was considering his options and considering whether and how to get involved in Syria. There was very little appetite coming right on the heels of Afghanistan and Iraq to commit American forces to yet another Middle Eastern or Western Asian conflict. And in fact, the Republicans made it clear they didn't want to go along with it as they denied him an authorization for the use of military force, particularly for Syria. Boy, oh boy, now Syria has gotten nothing but worse in the intervening years. And how much that's going to be laid at Obama's doorstep remains to be seen. Danny, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Brent. Brent's calling from Oakland. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My comment is that I think one of Obama's biggest failings, especially in the light of Trump, is that he used the Whistleblower Act to prosecute, my memory's failing, Chelsea Manning or Snowden to use the Espionage Act. Now we have this problem where Trump's already talking about using or trying to tighten up libel laws, and you know, he can now use that if anybody publishes anything that doesn't have an anonymous source. Now he's going to be able to use that against them.
Well, I think, Brent, as we look back, Edward Snowden is going to be one of those dividing lines where honest people disagree on just who he was, what he did, and whether it was valuable or treasonous, whether it was in defense of democracy or whether it was vandalism and theft. Clearly, you come out on one side of that argument.
Actually, I'm not strong on either side. I just worry about how the precedent that it set, if you can use the Espionage Act to go after somebody that's whistleblowing or somebody that has come across information that they got from an anonymous source, then that can set a very dangerous precedent for journalists.
Brent, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Pen Grove, California. Linda, welcome.
Hi, Ray. It's great to hear your voice on KQED again.
Thank you.
And I would like to say that I'm a 65-year-old white person who worked very hard on both elections to get him elected twice, volunteered many states, flew to Washington for both his inaugurations, and for me, for the rest of my life, I don't think I will have a president as positive and uplifting as this president has been. I just think I never could figure out all the animosity and the hatred and the anger to Obama except pointing it to me. I think race has a lot to do with why people have reacted, including the Republicans, with this. And, you know, I'm just listening to the people's email comments and talking about him being a loner. It just feels like, you know, Clinton was a schmoozer, Bush was a sort of cornball jokester, and to call Obama a loner, from my perspective as a citizen, I just feel he has just opened up the doors to the White House to so many diversified, the arts and the children and the veterans and the sports, and to think that people think that he's a loner, it doesn't connect for me, that he just seems much more personable than that. He's very pragmatic. He's very highly intelligent, and maybe people are just, you know, put off by that. I just don't get that sort of characterization of him being what, you know, he's not a good old boy on the Hill, but, you know, so what?
You heard Michael Scheer earlier in the program talk about how few people of either party on Capitol Hill were ready to say that Obama had forged a close relationship with them. Maybe he wasn't strictly speaking, a loner, but also it would be hard to make the point that he had a great relationship with Congress at a time when he really needed them.
Well, I think the walls were built very quickly when he became president, and, you know, I think it was just hard to... How many times did he go to the Hill to try to talk with them? I mean, there's just been so much pushback with the whole Congress with him. It just, to me, I just felt that he extended his hand many times. and just, you know, it was never accepted. So I disagree even with your guess. Even though he did talk to those people, do they feel that way now after 8 years? He just comes across to me, and I've seen him in plenty of rallies when I was helping to get him elected. He just comes across as so much more personable than he is characterized in Washington.
Linda, thanks a lot for your call. Thanks for joining us on Forum. The comments continue to come in. Anthony tweets, Cornel West put it best. Obama was the black mascot for Wall Street. Bailouts, no public health option, and Gitmo still open. I would direct people who are interested to The Guardian, where there are assessments of the Obama years, one scathing one from Cornel West, which is cited by Anthony, and then another one, side by side, from the historian Peniel Joseph, who talks glowingly about how difficult it was to be the first black family in the White House, to be the first black man in the Oval Office, and how black humanity was portrayed to the nation, and how important that will be over time. Shankar writes, I think our president overestimated the Republican Party and its elected representatives. He overestimated their patriotism, their desire to help the country recover from a devastating economic collapse, their honesty and constructiveness in working with him in a bipartisan way to address the country's problems. A listener writes, Obama has been an unprecedented disaster. It will take decades for this country and the world to recover, if it ever does. And Noel writes, I was glad about the release of nonviolent drug offenders. In fact, the pace of commutations and pardons picked up in these last final weeks, and Obama by far surpassed the number of people whose sentences were shortened and vacated altogether. Our number, 866-733-6786. Lori is in Mill Valley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about your guest comment early on in the show about the decorum of the first family in the White House. And I felt that he somehow made it sound like they developed a separate personality or public persona for one being the president and two being a black family. He didn't really mention the fact that they're just flat out good people. And I think, you know, they did a really good job of protecting their children from the public and trying to give them a normal teenage life. And that the reason they came off with so much grace is because they have it. And I think part of this might, not necessarily on your guest's behalf, but I think there's a really deep-seated bias. Not sure I want to call it racism, but bias against black people in this country. And I think that's what you saw in the election. And I think people have to really look within themselves and really think about how they feel about it.
I think you make a fair point, Lori. By talking about being conscious of the way that you present yourself to the public, you run the risk of implying that it's not genuine or not authentic. But would you agree that by being the first black family in the White House, they did have to give special care to the way they were presented to the country? You know, some of being president is performance. You are seen doing things, seen interacting with people, and that carries with it an electric charge. That carries with it symbolic weight, along with the policy things you do, the way you negotiate with Congress, and what you do about issues of war and peace. Because we don't have a head of state and a head of government who are two different people, like the United Kingdom, we put both roles in the same body. So you embody the country and you also run the government, the executive branch of the government. It's a high wire act, I think. And Obama, though it was probably infuriating to people who started out not liking him, he did manage that part of it quite well. I would agree with you there.
Thank you. Yes, I totally agree with you. There's a special level of decorum one needs to take as the president. And unfortunately, with being a black family, there's probably an undue, unfair burden on that. And I think the reason it came off so well and the reason there were no scandals is because they're just good people.
Lori, thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
You know, even with those efforts that Obama made to run the White House and run his public life in a specific way, there were those who sent around cartoons that filled up social media feeds of watermelon patches on the front lawn of the White House, of Obama dressed as a witch doctor with a bone in his nose and a fire at his feet, of photos of apes transposed onto the faces of the members of the first family. This kind of stuff happened no matter whether a charismatic person who looked great in a suit or a tux and a very style-conscious first lady were the inhabitants of the White House. That ended up not mattering because that kind of animus was going to be there no matter how they handled themselves. Palo Alto is our next stop. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm in the middle of your callers. I'm neither a big supporter nor a detractor of the president, but I think he will be viewed as a mediocrity who in several very important ways left the country worse than he found it. And I would single out two areas. One is rule of law. I think there's no question that our regulatory and other agencies have been captured, especially by the financial industry. And the Obama administration did nothing to halt that trend. In fact, in many ways, they made it worse. I think the Department of Justice is more politicized today than it's been since the Nixon era. And then secondly, in the area of race relations, I take your point about the people who crawled out of the woodwork and have attacked the president for racial reasons. But I think the president bears responsibility for accentuating the identity politics shift of the Democratic Party that has pushed many people out of the party. And he has been a huge contributor to the very horrible state of I was trying to avoid the word deplorable.
But Tom, how has he contributed to it, except by just the very fact that he is himself?
Sure, I'll give you an example, Ray. I used to be a Democratic Party activist. I wanted to volunteer for the president in 2012. I went to the website. I couldn't sign up because they said, identify yourself. I said, well, you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat. What more do you want? No, identify yourself. Are you gay, lesbian, black, Hispanic, woman, et cetera? I literally could not sign up to volunteer for the president. And we have seen the fruits of that identity politics obsession with the sanctuary cities craziness, with the ridiculousness of the Clinton campaign, not campaigning in Michigan, Wisconsin. I mean, the bedrock of the Democratic Party, the working class, industrial, Rust Belt states, they just wrote them off. That's insane. And I put that down to the president. He saw that coming, and he gave it a green light. The Democratic Party has been captured by that and by Wall Street. And you saw the low point of both of those trends with the Clinton campaign. And now we have Donald Trump as president. A large part of the blame for that rests at the feet of the identity politics folks, especially President Obama.
Tom, thanks a lot for your call. The Democratic Party is going to have to think about that for the next 4 years. And whoever decides they want to take a run at being the party's standard bearer in 2020 is going to have to think hard about that, because in reality, the Democratic Party does have support from interest communities of interest that are identified by who they are and what they are, along with a certain approach toward running the country, which people agree with and disagree with. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, identity politics, if it's making you lose and not helping you win, it's a big problem. We've put up a link to Cornel West's opinion piece on our website at kqed.org/forum. Trish writes, even if everything he accomplished is erased by the incoming administration, the fact that he succeeded where he did will remain in the history books, and that will be his amazing legacy. The other lesson his presidency has taught us, sadly, is that racism is alive and well in our country. William writes, President Obama is the best president since FDR. He turned a cratering economy into the greatest economy ever. created more jobs than Ronald Reagan, provided health care to over 25 million Americans, ended two wars, and found and killed the leader responsible for 9/11, Osama bin Laden. A listener writes, "The question is whether after his term ends, Obama has the decency to stay silent or whether his narcissism will have him trying to stay in the limelight. With the Clintons gone, he's all the Dems have, though, so I think we'll see more of him rather than less." I want to thank you all for calling in with your contributions, as the president is probably putting the final touches on his speech set for delivery tonight in Chicago, where it all began for him politically, and of course the people who contributed online as well. Thanks for everyone who called, and earlier you heard from Michael Shear, the White House correspondent for The New York Times. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with help from Jeremy Siegel, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Ray Suarez, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks a lot for listening. Stay with us. Bye-bye.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.